The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Thank you so much. It is a tremendous honor to be here at Westminster. I appreciate those very generous words from your president, and as he cited others, you may have many thoughts as you're listening to that, and one of them may be, if those things are true, evangelicalism must be a very intellectually impoverished movement. But nonetheless, I'm glad to be in a place that refutes that consideration. It's a great sense of indebtedness as I come to be at Westminster. It's a great joy to be here. It's not my first time on the campus, although it is my first time to have the opportunity to address a group such as this. I feel a great personal indebtedness to this institution. And that goes back a very long way. It goes back before I would even have known the names of any of the faculty members. Back when I was a college student, a religion major, trying to figure out what theology was, I came across Westminster's Theological Journal. And I know this may seem to you something of a sign of impending dementia, but I used to sit in the college library and just go through back issues of the Theological Journal, and I learned a lot of theology by doing that, and frankly learned a lot of theological literature as well. I didn't know a whole lot about Westminster, but I knew that it was a school that took scholarship so seriously. When I became president of Southern Seminary in 1993, in a moment of tremendous theological crisis for a denomination and for a school, I had very few resources upon which to draw in terms of contemporary institutions. But I want you to know that I was invigorated and inspired, and in many ways kept at it by the example of men such as Gresham Machen and those who founded this institution, who counted the cost and were willing to pay the cost. By God's grace, the Lord has allowed Southern Seminary to be reformed and to be renewed and to be returned to its roots. And I'm very thankful that there were roots to which we could return, and that there was a confession of faith that was there in order to be recaptured as the very foundation of what it means to be a confessional Baptist institution. And then that's an identity that we share with this school. That confessional heritage is the same confessional heritage. The founders of Southern Seminary were largely from Princeton Theological Seminary, and they borrowed Princeton's confessionalism, complete with Samuel Miller's explanation of what it would mean, and complete with the signing documents of old Princeton, in such a way that when Southern was established in 1859, it was established as a Baptist Princeton in the South. And thus we have a great deal in terms of what we share in common there. I want to thank you for allowing a confessional Baptist to be in the midst of confessional Presbyterians. It's a good place to be. That word confessional gives us a great deal of grounding as we are together. We know who we are and we know why we're here, and those are two good things to know. There are probably few Methodists here, so it's safe for me to tell you that one of my favorite stories about this kind of issue had to do with the great Methodist revivalist and evangelist, Samuel Jones. Sam Jones is preaching throughout the South, and he preached in Cartersville, Georgia, the turning point of the century. And he had a large group, and this was back when in the South we had what were called protracted meetings, and they knew how to protract meetings. They would go on for weeks and weeks at a time, and it was pretty much a full-body, full-calendar revival experience. There were prayer meetings in the morning for the men before they went to work. There were prayer meetings in the middle of the day for the women who could then go. And it was at the women's prayer meeting on a Tuesday morning that Samuel Miller looked out at all the women who were there, and I guess he was filled with some kind of denominational chauvinism or Methodist spirit, and he simply said, "How many of you here are Methodists?" And every woman in the room raised her hand, save one. And he turned to her and he said, "Ma'am, what in the world are you?" And she said, "A Baptist." Samuel Miller said, "Well, why are you a Baptist?" And she said, by the way, this is a bad answer, but she said, "Well, my grandmother was a Baptist, my mother was a Baptist, all my folks are Baptists, so I'm a Baptist." Sam Jones turned and said, Well, what if your grandmother was a fool? And your mother was a fool? And all your people were fools? Then what would that make you? And she paused for a moment and she said, a Methodist, I guess. I fully recognize that you could interchange any of those labels and it still works. But I'm very glad to be amongst people today who do not happen to be something. But you are Reformed and Presbyterian by your confession. And as a confessional Baptist, I'm glad to be amongst persons and at an institution with whom I and those who are with me in the Baptist tradition can share so much. And we await that day when the Lord Jesus Christ will sanctify and glorify his church. And on that day, our confessional unity will be perfect. And until then, we will be thankful that it is so strong and substantial as it is. When I was writing my doctoral dissertation, and Dr. Lilbach made reference to that, a good section of it included the consideration of Cornelius Van Til's engagement with Karl Barth. And I very much wanted to meet Dr. Van Til, who was here, and I made arrangements to come up and visit with him. It was no small feat, but I was able to gain an appointment to meet with him, and I made all the arrangements. This was back in the Pleistocene epoch when you actually had these little paper things that you got from a travel agent in order to fly on a plane, and they were non-refundable. And I received word just a few days before I was to arrive that Dr. Van Til had died before I could come and meet with him. I was crushed for a number of reasons, but mostly at the personal level. I desperately wanted to have met him, given the influence he had on my life. But I decided, since I had this non-refundable plane ticket, I would come anyway. And I came and was able to spend some time in the library and in his papers, and came to know something of this institution as I was a doctoral student here among you for just a few days. And I understand that that Grace Mullen still works in the library. I still remember her name because of her incredible graciousness and kindness to me when I was a doctoral student. We don't get to repay many things in this life that we would like to repay, so let me just say a word of appreciation there. I still remember that. It is a tremendous honor to be here, President Lilbach and faculty. I come as one who has such great esteem and respect for Westminster Seminary and who you are, and most recently for what you have demonstrated in terms of a commitment to confessional integrity and to the full authority and truthfulness of Scripture. And thus, it is good to be among friends. And to those of you who are students in this institution, I have a special sense of encouragement to you. I know you know what I'm about to say, but it is important that I say it and that you hear it. And that is that you know you bear the stewardship of being in one of the most unprecedentedly wonderful places for theological education ever in the history of the Christian church. And I know you feel the stewardship of that. I just want to encourage you, not just as a matter of institutional pride, though I know you feel that, but as a matter of your own personal stewardship. Get everything you can out of every class, every conversation, every moment, every book review, every exam. You know the drill. And God bless you for being here in the providence of God. Oliver Wendell Holmes, either senior or junior, and the historical record is vague and it is not clear, but in our American historical memory, they kind of blend into one person in any event. Oliver Wendell Holmes said this, "I would not give a fig for the simplicity this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity." First time I heard that, I immediately grasped upon it as something that brought me a tremendous amount of intellectual stimulation and actually intellectual comfort. The distinction made in that quotation between a simplicity on the near side of complexity and a simplicity on the far side of complexity is extremely helpful. It's the kind of statement that was made necessary by the advent of the modern age and by the development of the modern mind. That you might call the challenge of modernity the great complication that is in the background to Oliver Wendell Holmes' statement here. The background is the great intellectual upheaval that the human mind experienced and that our societies and cultures have experienced, especially in the West. It's a sentiment as distilled within this quotation that makes immediate sense to us because we know a longing for simplicity. but we are daunted by the challenge of complexity. If there were no challenge of complexity, if there were no challenge of the modern mind, of the Enlightenment, and all of the intellectual upheavals of the modern age, there would be no Westminster Theological Seminary. There would have been none of the theological crises with which we have had to deal as churches and denominations over the course of the last 2 and 3 centuries. But the complexity is very much there. We understand there are two different phases or two different forms of complexity implied in that statement. There is one on the near side of complexity, a simplicity before one gets to complexity that we might describe as naive. Well, we want simplicity, but we cannot afford a naive simplicity. It does not serve the Lord Jesus Christ and His church. For those who will bear the stewardship of biblical truth and the teaching office of the church, to abide in a simplicity that denies the complexity that so shapes the modern and postmodern mind. On the other side, there is a more sophisticated simplicity. And we are those who would wish to be intellectually sophisticated people. The problem is that there seem to be both true and false simplicities on the other side of complexity. And the great challenge is to get to a simplicity on the far side of complexity that is true. On the near side of complexity, we would describe this simplicity as childlike, perhaps even childish. On the other side, a more adult form of simplicity. On the other side of complexity, having engaged the issues, having come to an understanding of the challenges, understanding and undertaking an adventure on the other side of all of these intellectual upheavals, well, that's a different kind of simplicity. The one is disengaged from the challenge. The other is engaged but intact. We come to understand something of what this is like just in the course of our intellectual development. The child is not capable of abstract thinking, and the child thinks basically in linear forms, very simple forms, and then comes the intellectual tumult of adolescence when a part of what happens during that time in terms of the operations of the brain is that the adolescent brain begins to envision by the means of critical and abstract thinking realities that do not exist. For the first time, the child begins not only to think, but to think about thinking. And that leads to the Sturm und Drang of adolescence. But on the other side of that, adulthood needs to be marked by a self-identity and a self-knowledge that is another, but this time matured, simplicity. Even Plato and others in the ancient world understood this particular need, this part of the life story, and saw something pathetic in the one who went through the phase of childhood and then through the phase of what we might call adolescence, especially in our contemporary time, but never arrived at an adulthood. But there was even a greater condescension and sense of loss for the one who went through the entire spectrum of life without ever engaging the complex. The statement made by Oliver Wendell Holmes is very much reminiscent of that which was offered by Soren Kierkegaard, the melancholy Dane, who in his own way spoke of the great desire, indeed, as he saw it, the soul's thirst for a simplicity on the far side of complexity, on the other side of this great challenge, on the other side of critical thinking, on the other side of the Enlightenment. Is it possible to achieve or to find an authentic simplicity? Let's talk about how complex the challenge really is, just in terms of a brief recitation of what we face in terms of the challenges of the complex that separates those two simplicities. There is, of course, the great challenge of the Enlightenment itself, this great upheaval in human thought, the great turn to the subject, the rise of Cartesian skepticism, the rise of critical rationalism, of the Kantian revolution with critical philosophy, denying the knowability of the transcendent or the noumenal, the radical Enlightenment with its even more radical skepticism, its upturning of all things known and knowable, the historical skepticism that arrived with Lessing's Ugly Ditch and the impossibility of making historical claims about the past, the anti-supernaturalism that became part and parcel of the Enlightenment experiment in its most secular versions, and the rejection of the very possibility of revelation certainly any verbal or propositional revelation. We had the claim that humanity has now come of age, and in this new autonomous humanism, the human mind, the human consciousness, is now freed from all of its intellectual obligations to the past, to tradition, and to what were then seen as outmoded and unsophisticated understandings of truth. And then came the four horsemen of the intellectual apocalypse: Darwin and Marx and Nietzsche and Freud. It's very difficult for us to take an adequate intellectual measure or estimate of the impact of these four seminal thinkers and those who with them conspired in this great upheaval in human thinking. But we do know this: when it comes to Charles Darwin, the actual intellectual implications of his thought seem to be missed by most of those who were alive at the time. It was Darwin himself, and in some ways almost Darwin alone, who seemed to understand the implications of this great intellectual revolution in terms of the understanding not only of human origins, but of the meaning or meaninglessness of the cosmos. Karl Marx, to understand the essence of his own self-understanding of where his revolutionary thinking would take him, all you need to remember is his statement, "All that is solid melts into air." It's absolutely certain that the modern age burned away all of the old certainties and certitudes, all the old hierarchies and patterns and structures, and left nothing but the absolute will of the people to revolution and the need for the proletariat to conspire to begin a revolution that would lead eventually to the eschatology of the new communist man. He did understand that on the way, everything that is solid would melt into the air. And then Nietzsche. His declaration that God is dead was not, he believed, his invention, but his brutal honesty. He was absolutely convinced that he was saying what everyone else knew, but was refusing to accept nor to speak. Nietzsche believed that he was the one honest man in the midst of a conspiracy of dishonesty. And as he declared not only the reality that God is dead and that we have killed him, but the implications of this, he was certain that he would not be heard because human beings were capable of an infinite series of, well, what we would now call, using the contemporary theological language and the therapeutic language, denial. Nonetheless, refusing to exercise the escape hatch of denial, he intended to make very clear the implications of what it would mean for God to be dead and nothing but the will to power to remain. And then Sigmund Freud, just to complete this quartet. He comes along later than the others, and actually in terms of intellectual history, later than most of us remember. This was a man who fled the Nazis from Vienna in the early stages of World War II. But this was the man who, in his own atheistic worldview, provided the tools of intellectual revolution in order to bring about a subversive understanding of the human being, now freed from any theological or theistic implications, and thus rooted all human problems and human consciousness in, of course, the experience of the consciousness versus the subconsciousness, a complete secular self-understanding. By the time Darwin and Marx and Nietzsche and Freud, and by the time they had done their intellectual work and these ideas had seeped deeply within the culture, and now, of course, they're commodified in terms of the self-help section of your local bookstore, an intellectual revolution of unprecedented scale had occurred. And then we go back and see how this explains the rise of what we would call, and what was even self-consciously known at the time, liberal theology. This was the response mechanism. And thus we understand why Schleiermacher would address himself to the cultured despisers of religion. On the other side of the Enlightenment, Schleiermacher, who was, after all, speaking to a people whose hearts had been plowed by German pietism, shifted the entire concern of theology from truth to feeling, from the objective and exterior truth of the reality of a self-revealing God to the internal perception of a need, of a feeling for absolute dependence. When Schleiermacher addressed himself to those he called the cultured despisers of religion, his effort was to try to convince them that there still remains something valuable in the message of the church and in the essence of Christianity, something that could be redefined in terms that they would find, well, to be marketable and acceptable to those who saw themselves as the very keepers of this new culture. The lesson, of course, in Schleiermacher is that if you're going to try to market theology to the cultured despisers of religion, they will end up despising you for it. Then Ritschl and Trelch, again, shifting to sheer interiority, denying the scandal of particularity, is just too much for the church to bear. And then, of course, just about the turn of the century, you had Rudolf Bultmann and his program of demythologization. Bultmann understood the complex. He understood it. He didn't believe that there was any simplicity possible on the other side of complexity. The entire process of demythologization in the New Testament, he says, is made necessary by the fact that men who use electric razors and turn on electric light bulbs do not believe in supernatural realities. And it's hard to argue with that if all that we have is what Bultmann had left in terms of his confidence in the Christian message and in the Christian Bible. We come to understand that Bultmann's process of demythologization is made necessary if you're going to accept his premise. If you're going to accept his reading of not only the modern age, but what is salvageable of Christianity, then all you can do is to try to demythologize and find some kind of existential meaning in the ruins and remains of biblical Christianity. And then, of course, there are the other celebrated names of persons such as Paul Tillich, who said all that we can really know is that we have this need for that which is described as a ground of being, an existentialist approach that in its own nuances is quite clever, if not brilliant, but comes back to the fact that what you are left with is absolute secularity. Eugene Genovese, an historian at the University in Atlanta, Emory University, some years ago, was speaking of Paul Tillich when he said, you know, I'm an atheist, or at least he was then an atheist. He said, and Paul Tillich's an atheist. The difference is that I know I'm an atheist, and Paul Tillich does not know he's an atheist. Sidney Hook, another atheist, during Tillich's own lifetime, made the same point when he said, I'm an atheist, Paul Tillich's an atheist, it takes one to know one. We understand what this meant in terms of the course of modern theology when we consider someone like Adolf von Harnack. Harnack's understanding of how to rescue theology was, first of all, to diagnose where the problem began. And as he saw it, the problem began when the church started making what we would refer to as doctrinal statements. And when these doctrinal statements were made, he said it was due to the acute Hellenization of Christianity. It was because the church started borrowing from Greco-Roman thought in order to bring in elements, in order to buttress its truth claims, in order to build a structure of theology that would lead it to be able to compete with the intellectual alternatives of the day. And thus, von Harnack thought that the only way to capture the essence of Christianity is to separate what he called the kernel from the husk in order to get rid of the husk of this doctrine in order to get at the kernel of what remains. And of course, if you read his History of Dogma, you come to understand that at the end of the day, basically nothing remains. Because if you accept the fact that you're going to separate, as your methodological principle, the husk from the kernel, it turns out there isn't much of a kernel. More radical thought then followed. Of course, you had the death of God theology with Altizer and others, protest atheism that emerged not only outside the church, but inside the church, the rise of movements such as process theology, which was, after all, an abdication to philosophy, and liberation theology, which was an abdication to politics. And just when the picture was getting complex beyond what we thought complexity could bear, along comes a new intellectual movement that doesn't even consider itself modernist, but declares itself to be beyond that, or post-modern, or postmodern. It turned out in retrospect that postmodernism was really a hyper-modernity. It really is the end stage of modernity in some sense, and yet it also was a very transient project. It was a transient project in terms of its formal expression, but it is still very much an intellectual habit of those who inhabit this civilization. So along came the postmodernists, and by the way, it's very interesting that postmodernism, you'll recall, first emerged in architecture. The first time the word was used, it was used about an architectural style that sought to use a pastiche of different kinds of elements in order to defy all of the conventions. The postmodernists would use a Corinthian column here and a different ornamentation there, and would blend ancient and modern and classical and postmodern styles together in this intentional confusion of things, such that walls appeared to be tilting at weird angles and rooms appeared to be hanging in air. And the interesting thing that few honest men or women tended to note was that postmodern architects tended to have non-postmodern engineers. Even though the style might be postmodern, buildings tend to need a good respect for gravity. And thus, most postmodern architects were allied with very modernist engineers. But nonetheless, spreading from architecture to other areas of thought, postmodernism was a very convenient intellectual tool, because postmodernism, taking up on all of the gains of modernity, was able to distill this into a moral relativism, which always comes in ways that are very convenient to sinful human beings. As one historian has remarked, modernity has rationalized sexual misbehavior, and postmodernism has radically rationalized sexual misbehavior. You had the exhaustion of the European elites. Why did postmodernism emerge? Postmodernism emerged largely because of the failure of Marxism to deliver on its promises. The European elites, especially in academia, had largely given themselves over to Marxism, not necessarily to communism, but to Marxism. And yet, Marxist thought did not bring the liberation that it promised. After the student revolutions of 1968 in Paris and other European cities, things did not get better, according to those who were making such an evaluation. It got worse. The Marxist revolution did not come. Marxist philosophy did not deliver on its promises. Out of the exhaustion of that came the postmodernists, with Lyotard, for instance, looking at the death of the meta-narrative. Why? Because the meta-narrative in which they'd invested themselves, Marxism, failed. But then they looked back and said, well, the meta-narrative of Christianity failed. Thus, meta-narratives just don't deliver on their promises. There must be no possible meta-narrative. It must be impossible for all these different groups and different social structures to share accountability to one meta-narrative. So we'll just surrender this and live with our own small stories, petite narratives. But if Lyotard came with the death of the meta-narrative, then Derrida came along with the death of the author. Another very convenient intellectual trick. If we can free ourselves from the text, then we will be free indeed. Because the texts seem to have this lingering authority that those who would subvert a culture and a social order find very difficult to resist. But if the author can be declared to be dead and the text can then be declared to be indeterminate, well, then we go into an even deeper complexity. We just forfeit all claims or all goals of simplicity, because now we not only have an author and a text with what is traditionally at least assumed to be a meaning, but rather to an infinite number of meanings and permutations as different individuals and social groups and different classes engage the text whose author is dead. And then Foucault. If Lyotard was the death of the meta-narrative and Derrida was the death of the author, then Foucault is the most subversive of all, because he claims, much like Nietzsche, that everything that exists as a claim to truth is nothing but a barely disguised claim to power. And thus liberation is brought as culture is revealed to be a giant conspiracy of hypocrisy. And thus we simply, more or less, laugh at all claims of truth and dissolve all claims of intellectual accountability. Now, are we then left with sheer relativity? Well, one of the problems with the postmodern mind is, well, let's go back to the architecture and engineer for a moment. The architect could be postmodernist, but the engineer could not. It turned out that you can apply postmodernism to sexual ethics, but you can't really apply postmodern thought to banking. I've had a good many medical procedures. I don't want a postmodern cardiologist. I want a cardiologist who believes in a one-to-one correspondence of truth and reality. I do not want one who considers my circulatory system to be a matter of aesthetic interest. I want someone who considers this to be a matter of scientific, observable, testable, treatable reality. And of course, the postmodern academics, they believed in the absolute death of the author and the absolute relativity of the text, except for their tenure contract. Then the text had determinate meaning they were willing to defend in court. You know, I think of Walter Truett Anderson's parable of the three umpires here. If you've heard it, you'll remember it. He talks about the modernist umpire, and before the modernist, the pre-modern umpire, and then the postmodern umpire. And they gather together to have a conversation about how they do their work. The pre-modern umpire just believes in objective truth. That's all he knows. He's on the near side of complexity. And so he says, I call them as they are. It is what it is. A ball's a ball. Strike's a strike. That's just the way it is. There's an objective box. If it's in it, it's in it. If it's out of it, it's out of it. That's it. The modernist umpire says, you are so naive. Everything's a matter of perspective. It's all a matter of where you stand. You're standing in a different perspective, you have a different reality. It's naive to say it's just an objective truth. And the postmodern umpire was listening to the pre-modern umpire, and then he listens to the modernist umpire, and he's had it with both of them. And he said, you guys are both nuts. It ain't nothing till I call it. And understand that parable is to understand where, indeed, we are left if all we have is that postmodern revolution in human thought. We are left with nothing but a scourge and swamp of relativisms, of relativities. And yet no one can live that way, including even liberal academics. And thus postmodernism turned out to be a passing fad in terms of the intellectual elites. It has continuing influence, even as the elites have moved on into other intellectual habits. But in terms of theology, just when we thought modernity had passed into postmodernity, along come the new atheists to remind us that modernity is still very much with us. And we have four new horsemen. And as the four horsemen of old, Nietzsche, Marx, Darwin, and Freud, were joined by compatriots, so also these new horsemen are marked by their own colleagues and compatriots. We have, of course, Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens. These four are fascinating in and of themselves, as each of them, in terms of both biography and intellectual contribution, makes the point of just how we arrived at this intellectual moment. Richard Dawkins looks back to Charles Darwin, as does Daniel Dennett. But when Richard Dawkins looks back to Charles Darwin, he points out the fact that atheism, up until the time of Darwin, had no intellectually satisfying explanation for the cosmos. It was Darwin, he said, who makes it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Dennett, who teaches at Tufts University, came back and came up with the idea of Darwinism as a universal acid. Everyone in this room who's ever a little boy can understand the idea of a universal acid. Dennett said he came up with it when he was in the fifth or sixth grade sitting in a science class, and we've all been there. He said when he was a little boy, he came to imagine what would it be like if there were an acid that would burn everything. He said he imagined that first of all it would be in the beaker and it would destroy the beaker. And then it would leak out of the beaker into the counter and it would destroy the counter. And then it would destroy the classroom. He's getting excited at this point. And then it would destroy the school. And then it would destroy the city and the county and the state. And eventually, it would destroy the entire cosmos. This universal acid. He said only as an adult did he come to understand that Darwinism is that universal acid. That Darwinism intellectually dissolves everything. Because it claims to explain everything. And in explaining everything in a purely naturalistic and materialistic frame, it destroys all claims of anything else. Then Sam Harris. Harris comes along and even takes something that is so much a part of our national architecture of constitutionality as religious liberty and says we can't afford that anymore. These people are dangerous. Checking the argument not only that as Freud had said, that what you have is the future of an illusion when it comes to theistic claims, or as Marx had said, that it is an infantilism of the human mind. Along comes Sam Harris to say, these people are dangerous. These people who believe in God because they believe in a revealed truth are dangerous. They are not fit for a constitutionally chartered society. They are people who need to be ideologically isolated. And then Christopher Hitchens comes along. Hitchens considers himself one of the few honest men in any room. And when Hitchens comes along, he simply says, look, God is not great. This is not a good idea. This is not something we should yearn for. Looking back to the Victorian loss of faith, he said that was pathetic. They were yearning for something they thought they had lost. More like Nietzsche, Hitchens says, we should simply celebrate this loss and this liberation and get on with it. And the new atheists have their own expansion of their agenda, now with Richard Dawkins suggesting such things as that it should be considered child abuse for parents to raise their children in a theistic worldview. And any kind of religious faith, it should be understood as a form of child abuse. Now, just to consider this upheaval in human thought, just to consider the revolutions that we've so quickly and in cursory fashion traced, just remember that the word atheist did not exist in the English language until the Elizabethan era. There was no need for the category of atheist because atheism was not an intellectual possibility in any sense we understand it today, until at least the earliest rise of what became modern thought. Now, all of this complexity was predicted. It was predicted by the high priests of the intellectual elites. It was predicted, for instance, by those who framed the entire discipline of sociology, who said that, given the impact of modernity, given the rationalization of human life, given the bureaucratization of human endeavors, given the secularity of human life as we take control, as human beings dam up rivers and no longer need supernatural explanations for all things, there will be a process of inexorable, inevitable secularization which is going to shape the culture and then specifically will shape the minds of the people. And thus, sociology as a discipline was established with one of its central principles being this inevitable process of secularization. Callum Brown described secularization as two different things. First, he said it is a theory. It's important for us to understand, he understands, that there are two different dimensions here. The first is the theory of evolution. In other words, Callum Brown, a British sociologist, comes back to say, yes, we just need to admit that the first principle of secularization is that it's something that we thought would happen. He still thinks will happen. But then he's honest enough to say, secondly, it is a master narrative, to borrow from Jeffrey Cox. Secularization is not only a theory, it doesn't just have the status of a theory, something that is posited and supposedly testable and observable and we'll see, but rather it's a master narrative. It's not only what they thought would happen, it's what they thought should happen. It becomes their reading of history. It becomes their tool for the prediction of the future. Max Weber described this as rationalization. We understand that. So much of life around us is rationalized. It's reduced to a mere function of reason, of rationality, and what makes sense and what doesn't make sense in this society is largely judged, especially by those who are doing the intellectually judging, as a matter of the mere function of critical reason. Durkheim referred to this as disenchantment. As secularization proceeds, even those who are not immediately touched by the intellectual elites and certainly not among the intellectual elites will experience this same process of disenchantment because the supernatural will simply begin to leak out of their worldviews. It will leak out of their lives by what they pick up from the larger culture and by the thought forms that are shared, especially in successively younger generations. Peter Berger, at Boston University, the leading sociologist of religion in this generation, said this: ever since the Enlightenment, intellectuals of every stripe have believed that the inevitable consequence of modernity is the decline of religion. Now, that's just a straightforward statement. And in other words, it's not just sociologists. Intellectuals, he says, of every stripe have simply believed that the inevitable consequence of modernity is the decline of religion. As human beings come of age, as human beings experience the intellectual effects of modern thought, Christianity in particular, and religious belief in general, will decline. Now, Peter Berger is one of those intellectuals who has experienced two things. Number one, the chance to be honest and admit he was wrong. And secondly, the experience to live long enough to test his own theories. And Peter Berger has come back more recently to speak about secularization to say that secularization as a theory both works and doesn't work. And it's very instructive for us just to imagine for a moment where it does and where it doesn't work. He suggests that secularization did happen in Western Europe. Western Europe followed the plan. When the sociologists laid out what they believed would happen through rationalization and disenchantment and the eventual life and half-life of the intellectual thought forms of the Enlightenment, yes, what would happen happened indeed in Western Europe. Western Europe is now so thoroughly secular that the Times of London had to run a news article to explain to British people why there was a holiday called Easter. They've lost even a Christian memory. Well, secularization theory worked there, but then people say, well, it didn't work in the United States. You know, fully 90% plus of Americans tell pollsters they believe in God. 80% claim to be Christians of one sort or another. Americans have churches that are filled with people, mega churches that seem to be burgeoning with people. Where you find the suburbs, you find some giant building filled of people who think they're Christians. Peter Berger said, well, there was another place that secularization theory worked, even in non-secular America, and that turned out to be amongst the intellectual elites. A recent published survey, published by Oxford University Press, indicates that the vast majority of those who teach in the natural sciences consider themselves agnostics or atheists. And by that, we're not talking about 60%, but upwards of 85 and 95%. The intellectual elites are thoroughly secularized. As a matter of fact, if you want to go to Europe, all you have to do is go to Cambridge, Massachusetts, because the worldview there is pretty much the same as what you will find on the European continent. Berger, by the way, in a hilarious little anecdote, has done this massive study he did with others, a longitudinal study of relative religiosity of peoples across the globe. And some of you may have read this. It's one of those things that gives you both a chuckle and an insight. As it turns out that when they did this longitudinal study of relative religiosity of different peoples in the world, it was people in India, no real surprise here, in India, they discovered the most religious people on earth measured by religiosity, right? As Peter Berger says, you knock over a god every 5 or 6 feet in India. It's not a secular place. But what was the most secular nation measured by this? Sweden. Sweden was the most secular culture by any secular measure. And so Peter Berger, speaking of the United States, says we are a nation of Indians presided over by an elite of Swedes. So Peter Berger came back to say that secularization was basically falsified. In fact, he wrote a famous essay with that title, Secularization Falsified, because he was intellectually humbled by the fact that at least in North America, specifically in the United States of America, it didn't turn out the way he had predicted. But very recently, along come other sociologists, in particular Stephen Bruce in Great Britain, to come back and say, Peter, you were wrong, it was right. And in words that should haunt us, and research that should certainly have our attention, he has done what some others have done, but with far greater sophistication. He has shown that supposedly non-secular America is far more secularized than we think. It turns out, as he's able to demonstrate, that many of the people who are filling up those megachurches and who think themselves to be Christians are as thoroughly secular as are those who know themselves to be secular in terms of their habits of mind, in terms of their intuitions, in terms of their cognitive structures. And so he comes back to say, Peter, you were actually right. The sociologists were right. Secularization was not falsified. It just turned out to be more subversive than we ever understood. It turns out that secularization works so well that you can be secularized in the pews of a church. Peter Berger, by the way, offers us some intellectual tools to understand this complexity that are very helpful. Berger says that secularization turned out not to be inevitable in modernity, but pluralization did. Now, the distinction there may be slight and probably more important to Berger than to anyone else, but out of this, he has offered something which is very helpful to us. He says that in the modern age, the greatest temptation, the greatest frustration, the greatest subversion of truth claims is what he calls cognitive contamination. This is useful to you. It'll be useful to you pastorally. It'll be useful to you in thinking about missiology. It'll be useful to you in thinking about what you see in the mirror. He says, the experience of living in the modern world means that we are confronted by such a maelstrom and cauldron of different ideas and ideologies and worldviews that we are cognitively contaminated without recognizing it. And he says, what happens is that even persons who consider themselves to be Orthodox Christians find themselves cognitively contaminated by intellectual and theological viruses that we do not even know we're picking up. And that this spread like viral agents through a process of cognitive contamination that takes place in conversation, by engaging the media, by watching a movie or reading a book in ways that are so subtle. Well, then you realize that Stephen Bruce's retort to Peter Berger, you were right all along, you can be secularized while sitting in a pew, is actually something that Peter Berger already had the tools to understand through this category of cognitive contamination. And if we, by the way, as those who will teach and preach the Church of God to the Church of God, do not understand that we are speaking to people who 6 days a week, if not seven, are being cognitively contaminated, and we don't understand what we're up against. The most helpful analysis, I think, of this complexity, of the challenge we face on the far side of complexity, is offered by the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor. In his book, The Secular Age, he lays out a very helpful intellectual structure for us to understand what we're really up against. He suggests that if you understand the intellectual history of Western civilization, you need to see it in three different stages, each marked by a distinctive condition of belief. This category of conditions of belief is very, very important. We should pay heed to this. It is, in some sense, the categories of thought from which theology cannot escape, except, as I shall conclude, by one means of escape. He suggests that these three different sets of conditions of belief begin with the set of conditions described as impossible not to believe. In other words, this first set of intellectual conditions was an intellectual state in which atheism or unbelief was impossible because there were no intellectual alternatives to theism. He points out the fact that, as I've argued in even the use of the word atheist, that it didn't come about until it was intellectually necessary. No one had to have the term or the category until there was now a possibility of those who would deny. And as he points out, intellectually, in terms of most of human history, atheism has been an impossible intellectual assumption because there was no alternative explanation for the cosmos, for its existence, for its regularity. But in the early modern age, there arose a different set of belief conditions. And we shift from impossible not to believe to possible not to believe. And that is when, especially in the Enlightenment, with the rise of modern science and with the advent of modern knowledge, on the other side of all of this, from Kant beyond, there now is the possibility of not believing. And this stage of belief, of the possibility of not believing, Taylor basically roots from the late 17th century until the mid-20th century. During that period of intense intellectual change, it was clear that there are now plural possibilities, plural intellectual possibilities. The belief in God that previous generations knew as axiomatic now becomes a matter of will, now becomes a matter of choice. It becomes one possibility among others. But Charles Taylor is brilliant in suggesting that the moment that belief in God, the moment that theism shifts from a condition of beliefs, from impossible not to believe to possible not to believe, it implies a third stage, which is impossible to believe. And Taylor says that's exactly where the intellectual elites are now. They have been there for some time. It is not that they see theism as a bad intellectual choice. That was true of a certain set of belief conditions that were operating basically from the Enlightenment to the mid-20th century, but that set of conditions is no more amongst the intellectual elites. There, it is now not possible not to believe. It is literally impossible to believe. Christianity is no longer an intellectual possibility. Theism is no longer a usable or respectable intellectual tool. Well, if we have shifted in this way, and of course, most of the people that we know and pass in the mall or in the movie theater, in the restaurant or in our churches, they're not living in that first set of conditions of belief of impossible not to believe. They know it's possible not to believe. They know people who don't believe. They also, in terms of their own voluntarism, believe that they believe as a matter of their choice, and thus they have experienced this in a way that fits their own self-consciousness. And so most of them are living also not in that third stage of beliefs. That's basically limited to the elites. Most people are living in that set of conditions where it's possible not to believe, which means it's also possible to believe. But again, Taylor says the elites understand where this goes. It's inexorable and inevitable. That once it is possible not to believe, it then becomes at some point virtually impossible to believe. So what do we do? What is the guild done? What is the theological response to this? I want to suggest to you that theological liberalism in all of its various forms is basically a series of attempted rescues of Christianity from modernity. It's a series of rescue attempts. You will not find a theological liberal who believes that what he or she is doing is unhelpful. They believe what they're doing is not only helpful, but necessary. They look at the challenge of this complexity. They look at the challenge of the reality of modern thought, of critical philosophy, of this radical subjectivism, of everything from modernity to postmodernity, and they say it is impossible to live in a state of intellectual denial, and thus we're going to have to bring theism in general and Christianity specifically into an intellectual accountability to these things. And thus Protestant liberalism suggested we need to save Christianity from itself. In terms of a pastor example, it's impossible to do better than Harry Emerson Fosdick, who made very clear, just as Bultmann said, that men who turn on electric lights and use electric razors don't believe in supernatural realities. Along came Fosdick to say that people don't care about the Jebusites and the Hittites or whether they ever existed. What they care is to whether they can find a greater resource and assistance for their own authenticity. And Fosdick believed he was saving the church. When you look at his passionate sermon, Shall the Fundamentalist Win, he's totally invested in this. He is absolutely convinced that there is only one way to rescue Christianity from its inevitable flushing in the modern age, and that is by turning it into something else, bringing it into intellectual account. And that, of course, brings us to Machen. Machen's courageous insight was to understand exactly what they were doing and to take their argument at its face value and in its full force. And thus, in Christianity and Liberalism, he says that's exactly what they're trying to do. But what they do in trying to bring Christianity into account with the modern age is to create an entirely new religion, one that they claim is the same, but with any theological discernment is recognized as being absolutely different. Along come the New Orthodox, especially as evidenced with the example of Karl Barth. Here you have the effort to achieve a certain kind of simplicity on the far side of complexity, to say it's theologically possible to put together a theological system that will look affirmative, that will make claims, that will assert doctrines, but on a Kantian epistemology, on a foundation of critical philosophy. And the failure of Neo-Orthodoxy is the failure of trying to find a false simplicity on the far side of complexity. And then there are other movements, such as post-liberal theology, George Lindbeck and others. His fascinating work on doctrine, he suggests that the liberals have an expressivist understanding of doctrine. Doctrine is just a matter of self-expression. It's basically an emotivist kind of thing. This is, you know, I feel like God is love. It's more than that, but it's basically, as he said, the liberals don't believe in an ontological reality. They don't believe they're talking about a metaphysical reality. Instead, they're just talking about how it functions psychologically and in other ways. The Orthodox, he says, the conservatives, well, they're still trying to hold to a cognitive understanding of doctrine, but no one believes you can actually hold to that on the other side of complexity. You're not making serious truth claims. You're not making cognitive truth claims. And so he comes back and suggests a cultural linguistic understanding of doctrine. What can we do? Well, he says, let's rescue theology. Let's rescue the Christian project so that we're not saying that it's a universal truth. It's not a meta-narrative. We're not saying it is a matter of ontological, metaphysical reality. We're not saying that we're making cognitive truth claims. We're merely saying that it's a story, it's a powerful story, and it's our story. And thus, doctrine becomes the grammar of our own cultural linguistic system. Similarly, along came Hans Frey and others to make very similar arguments. And then you have the John Milbanks and the movement of radical orthodoxy, which is kind of a hyper-neo-orthodoxy. And then you have the very eccentric but influential contributions of someone like Stanley Hauerwas, who comes along and says, he describes himself as a high church Mennonite, which is the kind of oxymoron he enjoys playing with. But what you basically have is a retreat of the church into its own polis, so that you deny an intellectual accountability to the ability to, for instance, sing the hymns and read the texts. But in so doing, you have already, as a prior act, forfeited the fact that you're actually declaring this to be a public truth. It's now a private truth. Not just individually private, that would be too individualistic, but rather communally private in kind of a new Anabaptist version. And then there's the emerging church. Rob Bell, Brian McLaren, Doug Padgett, Tony Jones, and others. They're saying, look, you can basically have something on the other side of complexity, and it can be something pretty cool. But you're going to have to surrender the cognitive claims. You're going to have to make it all narrative and theodrama and surrender the cognitive content. Well, before leaving this, I want to suggest to you two other failed rescue attempts, and this is where I will get into trouble. The first failed rescue attempt that you might not expect, we will call fundamentalism. It was an attempt to defy the complexity. And as much as I must speak of the true fundamentalists with such respect, the movement eventually turn to doctrinal eccentricity and to intellectual separatism and disengagement that was not helpful. So we can admire their courage, and we can even stand with them in their cognitive claims, but not with the doctrinal reductionism, not with the theological eccentricities, not with a lack of theological engagement. We cannot live as if the complexity does not exist. We cannot live as if modernity did not happen. We're going to have to engage, we're going to have to engage and re-engage at every turn. Lastly, I would suggest to you that another failed rescue attempt was what we call evangelicalism. And here, though I wish I had more time, I would simply say that the reduction of evangelicalism to a parachurch movement, which is largely now a form of mass cult consumer religion, non-confessional and experiential and pragmatic, it turned out that that rescue attempt didn't rescue either. We see what is happening among young evangelicals, and we come to understand just what kind of failure we're talking about here. James Davison Hunter, 20 years ago or more, was talking about what he described as a process of cognitive bargaining. And this cognitive bargaining, what you have are evangelical young people, when they leave their childlike cocoon of the family and the church, and they arrive in the adolescent maelstrom of the, and speaking here intellectually, of the college and university, they all of a sudden are confronted with this war of ideas and cognitive claims, and they immediately, he said, enter into a process of cognitive bargaining. They walk in with a certain basket of cognitive beliefs, and yet when they leave the university process, they have bargained away in an intellectually sophisticated and largely non-self-conscious process. They bargained away so many of those cognitive claims that they leave having made a bargain with modernity during their academic experience that leaves them with a far smaller set of cognitive beliefs, a far reduced core of theological content. Christian Smith and his colleagues, first at the University of North Carolina and now at the University of Notre Dame, have suggested in this massive study of young people beginning in the ages of 13 to 18 and now in the ages of 18 to 24, that the actual beliefs, even of evangelical young people, comes down to what he calls moralistic therapeutic deism. That their actual belief system is well, like Stephen Bruce said, secularized. They've been secularized in our homes, and they've been secularized in our churches. All that remains is this moralistic therapeutic deism that comes down to the fact that moralistically, God wants people to behave, that therapeutically, God wants people to be happy, and that deistically, there is a God, but he doesn't have any particular claim upon my life, and he is not the essential reference point for my decision-making or my understanding of self-consciousness or self-identity. In two successive works following up on Christian Smith's two volumes, his allied researchers have come back to ask a very important question, that is, where did evangelical young people get the infection of this moralistic therapeutic deism? And the answer is they got it from their parents. And they got it from the pulpits of their churches. And they got it from those who have influenced them from within what was thought during James Davison Hunter's kind of prediction and the coming generation to have been safe. Turns out it wasn't safe at all. It turns out that many of our Christian churches have precious little Christianity. And that many Christian families are so uncommitted to catechesis and perhaps even so unable to engage these issues that their children are secularized as they grow up and even in what are considered to be Christian homes. I want to refer you to the 18th chapter of Matthew. Gospel of Matthew, chapter 18, familiar verses as we begin in verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "I would not give a fig for the simplicity this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity." Jesus said, "The one who enters the kingdom will enter like a child." There is a simplicity that is demanded, a simplicity of heart, a simplicity of trust, a simplicity of faith. It is that simplicity we must seek. It is that simplicity we must teach. That simplicity we must emulate. What would that look like? What kind of theology is up to this? I took the time going through that recitation of attempted rescue attempts to suggest to you that just about every possibility has been tried. The course of modern theology since the Enlightenment is a course of various rescue attempts and theological possibilities that have failed on their promises. The options are being reduced before our eyes. I want to suggest to you that there is only one mode of theology. There is only one mode of churchmanship, one mode of ministry that is up to this challenge. The challenge of presenting with authenticity a simplicity on the far side of complexity, and that is confessional Protestantism. It is so because it stands upon a clear claim to the authority, truthfulness, and trustworthiness of Scripture, which rests on the prior assumption of the authority, truthfulness, and trustworthiness of the self-revealing, self-existent God. It understands that this God is not only knowable, but he makes himself known in ways that are cognitively accessible to us only by the divine gift of revelation. The issues are then isolated for us in that the only way through the complexity of modern knowledge, the only way through the complexity of modern thought, the only way to achieve a simplicity on the other side of complexity is an absolute, undiluted affirmation of the possibility and actuality of divine revelation. And that is found only in confessional Protestantism, which believes that if such is true, we are theologically accountable to it, not only in the whole, but in its parts. And thus I end by suggesting to you that we are able to look backwards at the course of modern thought and the course of modern theology to arrive at the point where we understand that faithfulness to the gospel and faithfulness to the teaching of Christ, as found even here in Matthew chapter 18, means that the only way we can get there is by self-consciously operating within the accountability and the nourishing home of confessional Protestantism. The accountability is first of all to God and to His revelation, but thus also necessarily through confession, to make certain that we are saying what Scripture says and teaching what Scripture teaches, that we are believing what God has revealed. And then there is a certain simplicity, a simplicity that the Reformers distilled down to sola scriptura, sola fide, sola Christus, sola gratia, soli Deo gloria. And what are the stakes here? Look back at Matthew chapter 18. We dare not end with verse 4. Jesus continues, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it will be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea." I think it's fair to say that at least included in that warning from Jesus is the warning of the pastor or the one who holds the teaching office of the church or the parent of a child, taking that child into complexity, taking that congregation and leaving them in complexity, speaking of theology and of the things of God as if we are left with nothing but complexity, and never bearing full witness to simplicity on the far side of complexity. Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "I would not give a fig for the simplicity this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity." We don't have to give our life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity, because Jesus Christ gave His. Let's pray.